Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our fifth installment on Megillat Ruth, the Book of Ruth. To quickly bring ourselves up to date, Ruth comes back with a copious amount of barley. Naomi sees her coming from a distance, and she's stunned. She says, "Oh my gosh, who took recognition of you, my dear, that you should be given such honor and such food?" And she says, "Who took recognition of me? Oh my gosh, what I did for this man today. You have no idea. He's heard all about the things that I had done for you and my beloved mother-in-law Naomi, and what I did for Mahlon, my dead husband, and everything I did by forsaking my land of Moab and coming here to Israel." And he really was just transfixed and inspired by me. So don't ask what he did for me, but rather ask what I did for him, which is a beautiful mutual type of relationship that Ruth is expressing to Naomi. And we ended last week by talking about this idea of the word haker, recognize, because she uses the word a couple times, that he took note, he recognized you. And we said that that harkens us back to a time where Judah, of all people, who of course is Boaz's great-great Zaidi, great-grandfather, was given an ultimatum, essentially. His moral self versus his logical self, self-preservation. In that Tamar, his own former daughter-in-law, had been impregnated by himself. He didn't know this. And she, rather than embarrass him publicly, sends all the evidence to him and says, "Look, I'm willing to die. It's up to you to take responsibility in public or not. Hakerna, please recognize. Who does the signet ring and the cloak and the staff, who do they belong to? Do you recognize them, please?" And he, of course, says, "Sadkami men." He gets up in public and says, "She's more righteous than me. I accused her of infidelity, and all along I was the one." And we said that that is actually a payback, because it was Judah who went to beloved father Jacob, Yaakov Avinu, and in the aftermath of the sale, the mechira, the sale of Joseph, he said, "Hakerna, please, Dad, do you recognize this torn up dream coat, this technicolor dream coat? Do you recognize it, please?" So the same mida keneged mida, quid pro quo, was issued there. And here, it connects the dots, because Boaz comes from Judah, and then you have the same word that brings us full circle to the story of Boaz, who is a descendant of the self-same Judah. So let's continue tonight with the dialogue at the end of chapter 2, Perek Beis, between Ruth and Naomi. And we're in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, 21. Vatomer Rus HaMoavia, Ruth the Moabite said, "Gam ki amar elai," also, "this man Boaz, he said to me, that im ha-ne'arim asher li titbakin, that I should stay close to her ne'arim, her young men, ad in kilu, until they have finished es kol ha-katsir asher lo, all of my harvest." Now, of course, this is not true. Boaz had never said stay with the young men. He said cling to the young women. So what's going on? And in fact, the next verse, gently, Naomi corrects her and says, listen how she corrects her. In verse number Chaf Beis, Vatomer Naomi al Rus Kalasa. So Naomi says to Ruth, her former daughter-in-law, "Tov biti, good my daughter, ki tetzi im na'arosav, you should go out with the young women that belong to him." She gently corrects him, says obviously he's not going to say stick with the boys. He meant stick with the women, which of course is the truth. V'lo yifgu vach b'sarecher, let you not be annoyed, let you not be molested in another field. So stop for a second. So what's the point of the idea of the na'arim versus na'arot? Now, a na'ara is a young girl. A na'ar is a young boy. Very close. Now, we know in English, and apparently in Moabite language, nouns do not change based on feminine versus masculine. But in Hebrew, they do. So perhaps she made an error. Now, how do we know that she made an error? Because the previous verse says, Ruth the Moabite said that Boaz had said, stick with the Na'arim. Now, unbeknownst to Ruth, who wasn't an expert in dictuk and grammar, perhaps she didn't understand that the word Na'arim was specific to young men, to the exclusion of young women. So by telling us it was Ruth the Moaviah who said that Boaz said, I should stick with the men, she meant the women, but she just didn't understand the language well enough to articulate it, and therefore it's correct. That's one possibility. The other is that she's being essentially modest about herself. And she's saying, look, Boaz is the chief rabbi of the world. He's not interested in me. So, yeah, I'll grant you, mother-in-law, that he may have designs that I should get married. I understand this. I'll grant that to you. But not for him. He said, you know, stick with my young men. Maybe you'll find an eligible bachelor among my young men that will be a great husband for you, great husband material. That is perhaps the intent. In other words, she's clearly changing the facts, because if you go back now, you will see in the previous verse when we see the dictate of Boaz, he actually says to her that, stay with my maidens, back in verse number 8. If you just go back for 1 second, the last words are, V'chotit bakin im na'arotai. You should stay like glue, stick like glue with my young maidens. He never said stick with the young men. That's improper. So it could be, according to one opinion, she didn't understand the minutiae of the Hebrew language, because she's a Moabiyah. That's why it accentuates the fact that she's a Moabite. She didn't understand that the rules in Hebrew don't apply like they do in Moabite language. That's one possibility. Or she was just simply stating a very modest fact. Yeah, maybe he's thinking, trying to find me a shidduch, trying to find me a match. But it's not going to be him. He's beyond me. He's the chief rabbi of the generation. It must be that he maybe sees a prospective mate among the young Jewish men, and he's saying, it's okay for you to marry among them. Okay? Not a crucial issue, but just interesting. Okay? Let's carry on, please. Let's finish off the parak, the chapter, at the very, very end of chapter 2, parak beis. Vatidbak b'na'aros Boaz lelakeit ad kelos kitzir ha-se'arim u'kitzir ha-chitim. And so, listening to her beloved mother-in-law Naomi, Ruth stays close to the young women of Boaz as they glean until the completion, the end, of both the barley harvest and then the later wheat harvest. Vateshev et chamata. And she stayed at home with her mother-in-law. So the argument again, did she used to come every day at night and sleep with Naomi so Naomi wouldn't be alone? She's an old lady. Or was she out in the fields with the young maidens the entirety of the harvest of the barley and wheat and then came home? But one thing we know, that for 90 days, nothing happened. She gleaned, she had lots of food, no one hurt her, she had plentiful food for Naomi also, everything was going okay, but there was no action on the shidduch front, on the matchmaking front. Nothing happened. Now let's just step back before we begin the next chapter. If you're Boaz, and you do have marital designs on this beautiful, young, gracious girl, Ruth, this exceptional human being, you're 80 years old, you're an octogenarian. What could you do at that point? She's 40 years old, she looks 20. She is beyond words. The rabbis describe her in very, very sexual ways as being so alluring that when men would see her, they would just go crazy for her. So she was really drop-dead beautiful, okay? But how is he supposed to even approach her? He's 80-year-old chief rabbi. What is he going to go to, like, saw you at Sinai, you know, dating site, Frumster, and look up Ruth and say, yeah, you know, let's go on a date, please. Let's propose. Would you get a shadchan at that point? You get a matchmaker, make me a match? It's not a matter of, like, rejection, so to speak. But he's an 80-year-old rabbi who's been married before. He's buried all those children. It's kind of like the end of his life. So how can he even presume that Ruth would even be interested in someone of his age? And from Ruth's perspective, it's the opposite, right? Yes, she's beautiful, she's young, but she's also a Moabitess, who up until literally a week or two ago was thought to be from a maligned, outside the machan, outside the camp type of situation where she could never even marry a Jew, let alone the chief rabbi of Israel. So from Ruth's perspective, where is sort of the common ground in between? There's a huge chasm that separates them in so many ways. So what is Ruth's response to Naomi? He said, stick with the young men. I'm out of the parsha. At best, I get to marry one of the young men of Boaz, which would be great. That'd be fantastic. Naomi knows better. She said, no, my young girl. He never ever proposed that you stick with the young men, that you should have a shidduch, marry one of the young men. But let's try it your way, okay? Let's wait. So they wait 90 days. They wait until the end of the barley and wheat harvest. Nothing has happened. So you'll see in a moment, the amazing chapter 3, Per Gemel, Naomi basically says to Ruth, look, we tried it your way. Did anything happen? No? How about we maybe take my initiative, let's do it my way? I want to preface chapter 3. Some of the events are going to seem a little out of character with the enormity of the piety of the people that we're dealing with, especially Boaz and Ruth. Remember, this is the lineage of King David and the Messiah. And if you examine it from a cynical, sarcastic point of view, a person could make accusations against the Jewish people and against the high and mighty chosen people, in the same way that we don't approach the story of Judah and Tamar in a salacious way. If a person is not big enough and is not a believer, we dare not go there because a person could open themselves to ridicule the Torah. So what we're going to share tonight is something on an adult, mature level. So anyone listening at home under the age of 17, please turn off the MP3 at this point and ask for parental consent. But we're going to go into some issues that are hard, you know, but we're big guys and ladies, so we're gonna go where no rabbi has gone before. So we're gonna try our best, okay? Perek Gimel, the third chapter. So 30 days, 90 days have passed. Now, why is 90 days significant? So when a person becomes a convert to Judaism, chooses Judaism, what they call a ger tzedek, a righteous Gentile, there's a 90-day waiting period. Anyone can imagine why 90 days? Because we want to make sure she's not pregnant from before her conversion. So 90 days are called the Yemei Havchana. They're days where we just make sure there's no prior pregnancy from before her former life. Obviously, it only applies to a potential giyoret and not to a ger, to a female, not to a male. But there's a 90-day waiting period before we allow her to get married. So that 90-day waiting period, coincidentally, is now done with the end of the wheat harvest. So now Ruth is good to go. She can get married now. Okay? So Naomi, the beginning of Perek Gimel of the third chapter, says, but Tomer la Naomi Chamota. So Naomi, her mother-in-law, says, Biti, look, my daughter. Halo ava kishlach manoach asher yitavlach. Haven't I always looked out for you? I must now seek manoach, rest, security for you. What's good for you? That it should go well for you. Now, Manoach is a very loaded word. It's in the first verse of Perek Gimel. Remember what Manoach was? Manoach is Shimshon's father. He's the reason that Boaz lost everybody in his family. Remember I alluded to this? The Talmud says that Manoach and his wife were barren. And so when Boaz, the richest Jew in the world, made all the chasimas, made all the simchas, made all the weddings for his children, he felt that if I keep inviting Manoach to every simcha, and I want to, he'll feel, and this is again an issue of mutual relationship or not, if I invite him to 120 weddings and he has no children at all, he'll never be able to reciprocate. And he's going to feel at some point, oh my gosh, I can't keep going to his weddings and, you know, eating the shmorg of Boaz, and I'm not going to have a chance to reciprocate. That's not right. So out of deference to the sensibilities of Manoach, a sensitivity, he didn't invite him. But that became a huge issue because he lost his family. Every one of them was buried. Now Manoach, of course, was blessed with a son. We said his name was Samson, Shimshon and Gibor, the great Samson. Okay? Not a popular figure, by the way, among the Philistines. So that was from Manoach. So here, they're using the word, Shmuel HaNavi is saying that Naomi says, I have Manoach for you. I want security. I want the best for you. But what she's going to propose is going to be a little outlandish, to say the least. And like I said, the rabbis have a lot of difficulty trying to contextualize what's going on here. Pasuk Beis, the second verse. V'ata. So now, my dear, we've waited 3 months. Has anything happened? Nothing, right? Halo Boaz modatanu? Isn't Boaz our relative? Asher hayis es na'arasav, the one who you were with his maidens all along for the last 90 days. It was your idea, Miss Rose. You said that I should stick with the maidens and we'll see what happens. Well, let's think about it for a moment. Boaz is at the field almost every day. If he didn't ask you for a date, to go to Starbucks for a coffee at this point, you're not going to see him anymore because the harvest is done. In fact, the end of the threshing, all that is like imminent. So if nothing happens now, if for 90 days he sees you every day, he never asks you out, how do you think he's going to ask you out? You're going to be out of sight, out of mind going forward. So we did it your way. Now we're going to have to do a little bit extreme measures because we chose to follow your option. Didn't work, did it? Let's do my way, Naomi says. Listen to what Naomi says. It's crazy. Hinehu, behold he, Boaz, Zoreh, as Goren Hasarim Halayla, this night, he is going to be winnowing barley tonight on the threshing floor. This is like the last opportunity you're going to have before it's all over, the harvest and everything, to meet up with Boaz. Tonight's the night, my young lady. So what should you do? Now it gets a little tough, so we'll talk about this. Pasuk Gimel, third verse. V'rachatzt v'sachat. You're going to bathe. You're going to anoint yourself. They say in Yiddish a very beautiful expression. You're going to get all farpitzed. Dressed to the max, to the nines. V'samt simlo saich alaich. You're going to put your nicest dress, your finery upon you. V'yaradet. And you will go down. Hagoren, to the threshing floor. Al tivadi'i la'ish. But don't make yourself known. Don't, in other words, expose yourself to the man, meaning Boaz, ad kalasola chovelishtos, until he has had a chance to finish eating and drinking. Let's stop. Now, do you notice that there's some words here that are written one way but pronounced another? Okay, there's actually, if you look, let's go back to verse number Gimel. So we have, the first word is virachatzt. You should do rechitza. You should bathe, which the rabbis say, go to mikvah, because you are a convert. Any idolatry from your past, now that the 90-day waiting period is over, you go to mikvah, immerse yourself spiritually, and get ready for Boaz. This sachat, and anoint yourself. And then it says the word v'samt, which means place upon. But the word samt is followed by the word simlo saich alaich, and then it says the word v'yaradeti. But it doesn't, it only says it in the actual, what's called, ketiv, the way it's written, has a yud at the end. But if you look on the right-hand margin, it says, v'yaradit, and then there's a kuf with a little hey. That kuf means kari. That's the way we read it, al pi the mesorah, according to the tradition of the rabbis, from Sinai. This is what's called a halakha, a law, Moshe Mitzrayim, given to Moses by God at Sinai. Part of the revelation was how to correctly read these words. So if you read it just inside the text, it has a yud, but there's no yud. But what if you read it with a yud? What would the word mean? So without a yud, it's for yaradit, feminine. You should go yarad, down. Go down to the granary, to the threshing floor. But if you write it with a yud, then it's talking about me. For yaradati, I will go down to the threshing floor. Meaning, Naomi will go down to the threshing floor? Well, it can't be, right? So that's clearly why we read it as, you should go down, Ruth. I'm not going down. I'm an old lady. What does that mean? But it doesn't stop there. Let's go on for a moment. You'll see. It repeats itself. It says in the next verse, Dalet, number 4, Vihi vishochbo, and it will be, after he eats and drinks and has his fill, and he lies down, V'yadat et hamakom, you should make a mental note of the place, asher yishkav sham, where he lies down, because it's going to get dark very quickly there. Uvat, you will come. V'gilit, you will uncover, you will reveal. Margalotav, his feet. And here's another word, oh my gosh. V'shachavt, but we don't pronounce it the way it's written, right? Because really it's written v'shachavti. I will lie down. I will lie down? Naomi? What? V'hu yagid lach, and then he will tell you after you uncover his feet, et asher ta'asin, what you are to do. Okay, so let's just go over this for a moment. So Naomi says, look, direct action isn't necessary. Inaction means you're never going to have another opportunity to meet up with Boaz. So we did it your way, let's do it my way. Dress your best. Go down tonight. We know where he's going to be. Now, the rabbi said, well, what would Boaz be doing down there? This is like Steve Jobs. Okay, so Steve Jobs is going to go down to the factory floor and sleep with his iPad Air Part 3, because he's still worried, or the watch, right? The Apple Watch, if he's still alive. So he's going to go to the factory the night before they make the worldwide distribution of the Apple Watch. He's so nervous that he's going to himself sleep, have a little cot there. What was he worried about? So the rabbis say, well, that was an immoral generation. And he was worried, you know, people will come. It's just now, past this horrible drought that they had that almost destroyed Israel. So there are immoral people in the generation. And also his workers, he's worried that there might be some, you know, hanky-panky going on. Now, it's kind of ironic, right? Because the theoretical hanky-panky could be involving himself. So it's kind of like he's going down to be the watchman, look over the young guys and girls, make sure that they're not mixing in the mixer, you know? And he himself is going to be subject to the young lady coming to him and uncovering his feet. So it's a little bit of an irony, okay? But why in the world would we have the Torah, specifically these verses, written one way, but read another way? So just to explain, this is not a unique phenomenon. It does happen in Tanakh. It's one of the reasons you need the Torah Sheba'al Peh companion, you need the oral tradition to help us with this. So we had two so far, right? We had Vi'aradet, as opposed to Vi'aradeti, I shall go down in verse, the end of, middle of verse number 3. And then in verse number 4, I will lie down is really the way it should be read, but we don't read it that way. It's you shall lie down, but it gets worse. Turn the page for a second. So, how do you think Ruth responds to this direct approach? Now think about it. Naomi is saying you have to expose yourself in a very profound way. And we'll talk about the symbolism here in a moment. But let's just get to the crucial, how we even read the verses and why they're written this way with this very strange structure. It's going to have an amazing kick, I promise. Vatomer Eleha. So she, Ruth, responds to Naomi. And even if she didn't agree, which is one of the implications here, with what Naomi's asking, even if she thinks this is absolutely insane and I don't want to do this, she says, kol, everything, asher tomri, that you say, now there's a missing word here. If you look back again in the margin, it says, there's the little circle, right? This is the craziest one of all. It says the word a lie. Everything you say a lie to me. The only problem is, what does it say after? I'll read the Hebrew for you. There's four words after the little circle in the margin. It says, a lie, Kari. We read it as a lie. Veloksi. But it's not even written in the text. But we have a tradition that whoever reads the Megillah has to add a word that doesn't even appear in any shape or form. So before, it was a matter of a letter. Is it, I go down, you go down. I lie down, you lie down. That's not such a big issue. It's one letter. At least the word exists in some context, in some form. Here there's not even a word. We're supposed to add the word, which is like, what? Well, I mean, what does that mean? Again, I'll read it to you. Ruth responds to Naomi, but she says to her, kol asher tomri, everything that you say, and we have to add the word to me, a lie, esa, I shall do. What is going on here? So the rabbis have a lot to say here. Simple explanation, as they say, the pashup shot is that she is being a surrogate of Naomi's. Why? Because who lost everything in the horrific, horrific famine and the whole issue? It was all Naomi. She lost her husband, Elimelech. She lost her sons, Mahlon and Chilion. So we are trying to rebuild the house of Naomi, so to speak, correct? So she's saying, you're going to be my shaliach, my shlucha, my messenger, my emissary. I would like to come down with you. So what will come down? My merits. My Torah, mitzvos, everything I have done in this world, Naomi says, should accompany you, my dear, tonight. In other words, when you go down, you're going down for both of us. I can't come physically, so I will send whatever merits in God's eyes that I possess, they should accompany you down to the granary and help in your successful mission tonight with Boaz. It's a beautiful way, nice way of explaining it, right? It doesn't explain, though, the Eli. It explains only the why is it I versus you. That it explains. But the Eli is stunning. So again, we read a word into the text by tradition, by law of Moses at Sinai, that doesn't even appear. It's implied, But it's not necessary for the verse. You could just say, everything you say, I shall do, right? That even makes sense. You could read it that way. But traditionally, if you read it that way, without the word Eli, you didn't fulfill your mitzvah of reading the Megillas Rus, the Book of Ruth, correctly. Why should that be? In other words, think about it for a moment. The word Eli, what happened to it? It just disappears. It's not there. Who's the Eli referring to? Ruth. Everything you, Naomi, say to me, only there's no me here. Why is there no me? You know why? It's my rabbi. You have no me because she's saying that I'm giving myself bodily, physically, over for this mission. Whatever you ask me, even if it makes no sense to me, even if I'm exposing myself to Boaz in a very profound way, I don't know, I may be rejected. I don't know what's going to happen. He may be mortified to the point where he curses me. I don't know what the end result's going to be. But what my sensibilities are about this issue make no difference to me. I am going. Only there's no me. I'm willing to go, and whatever I'm doing is for you. That's how much I'm giving myself over. Again, what does that sound like?
Isaac,
absolutely. Isaac on the Akedah, where he's willing to go and give himself over. What about the Jewish people at Sinai? They're saying, whatever it takes, I'm there. It matters not what I, the I part is gone. There's no I here at all. So it's totally selfless, profoundly selfless. Now, I heard something today of all places. I was listening to a class from my Rosh Hashiva. My Rosh Hashiva's daughter, Bas Nadiv Weinberg, piped up and added something which was mind-bending to me. Ready for this? This brings a full circle. What was the name of Naomi's dead husband?
Eli
Melech. Eli Melech. Eli Melech. To me shall be a king. Because he used to walk around very haughtily saying, I'm hot stuff. The kings of Israel will come from me. Now, was he right? Yes. Was he right in the way he thought he would be? Of course not. He was decimated. He was wiped out. But it did happen. How did it happen? In other words, if you take away the word Eli from Elimelech's name, what do you end up with? Just the word Melech, king. So the problem with Elimelech was that it was all about himself. Eli HaMelech, the king's for me. But once you throw the Eli out, like Ruth does, that's when you create the king. Because a king can only emerge as someone who doesn't have identity for himself. He's representative of the people, right? As soon as you foist him and say, well, it's for me because I'm so egotistical, I believe I'm the hot stuff, then there's never a king from you. It took someone like Ruth who threw the Eli away. There's no me. I'm not here. Then you have a Melech. Then you have a king. And think about a king in his essence. The Torah tells us that a king who attempts to say, don't stand for me, don't show me honor, we ignore that request, even though he's the king. Why? Clearly, the king represents the people. What right do you have to say, don't stand for me, when you are part, an extension of the people? You have no right. You're not an individual anymore. In other words, if you think about it, a king is supposed to be the poorest person in the world. He's supposed to reflect the will of the people and nothing more. He's an extension of their will. I know it got corrupted along the way, but essentially he's an evid of the people. He's the ultimate servant of the people. He's an expression of the people. So therefore, Eli Melech, from me comes the king, it's not rectified until Miss Ruth says, I don't care so much about myself at all. I matter not. Therefore, throw away Eli, just like throw it out of the Megillah. So it's not even in the Megillah itself. And then you end up with a king. That produces the king, having that sense of humility. Okay, let's carry on. So now we get to some very difficult psukim. Okay? Well, let's do it. Vateret HaGoren, so she, Ruth goes down to the granary. Vata'ask, Kol Asher Tzivata Chamosa. She did everything according to what her mother-in-law commanded her. Vayochel Boaz, Vayesh Vayitav Libo. Boaz ate and he drank, and his heart was merry. Vayavol Lishkav Bikzeh HaAremah. And he came to lie down at the end of the grain pile. Vatavol Balat, she comes very stealthily, very sneakily. She sneaks in. Vatigal margalosa vatishkav, and she uncovers his feet and she lies down. Now, what's the significance of the feet? Remember what Naomi said. You have to take off his shoes and lie at his feet. Ah, I'm glad you asked. There's a significance here. Remember we talked about levirate marriage, yibam? If the dead brother's younger brother chooses not to marry his former sister-in-law. For whatever reason, he does a ceremony called chalitza. He removes his shoe as part of the ceremony. So she, by removing Boaz's shoes, is giving a very direct hint. What's going on here, Mr. Boaz? You are potentially my redeemer. So I've been waiting months now. Let's take off the shoes. Do you want to let me go and marry someone else? Or are you yourself ready to step up to the plate and marry me, to do levirate marriage with me? Yibam. So that's the symbolism of uncovering the feet, that he is being given a very direct hint. Let me explain levirate marriage, because I think it's an important thing, and I think this is really, really, really going to bring this home. Okay? This is amazing. What is levirate marriage? Levirate marriage is essentially trying to give a legacy to a dead person, trying to give them a way of eternity. So let's just pick Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are all brothers. Abraham marries Sarah. Abraham dies. So it is a mitzvah for Isaac, the younger brother, to marry Sarah because there were no children. If he chooses not to, they do the chalitza ceremony. If he chooses to, he just does yivam by marrying her. And that first child that they have together belongs, essentially, the soul of the dead brother Abraham sort of lives through that child. So you're giving your first child, essentially, to your dead brother. Now, in pre-Sinai times, yivam, levirate marriage, meant life should go on at any cost. So the first time we have levirate marriage is a bizarre form of levirate marriage. The Zohar, beautiful book of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, The Brightness, talks about this levirate marriage. Can you guess where this levirate marriage takes place? In a cave, not too far from the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot has just left Sodom with his two unmarried daughters and his wife. His wife, unfortunately, turned into a pillar of salt. Okay, not a good thing. They go up into the cave. The young girls are under the mistaken belief that it's not just Sodom, Gomorrah, and the other two cities that have been destroyed, but the entire world is gone. And they're looking around saying, oh my gosh, you know, if we don't procreate, humanity is dead. And they look over at their father and they're grossed out. They're thinking, this is gross, this is horrible. But we need his seed. We have no choice here. It's like Adam and Eve were given a dispensation, according to the rabbis, of marrying their sisters. It was okay because there was no one else to marry at that time. Even though it's incest, it's against the Torah, and it would involve mutations and, you know, really horrific things for the children. In this case, it was permissible. So in the eyes and mind of the Benos Lot, of the unmarried daughters of Lot, they had no choice. They thought the world was dead. So they got their father drunk, unbeknownst apparently to him, although, you know, rabbis say, well, by the second night, he must have had some awareness, we don't know. They essentially get seed from him, and each of them gets pregnant. Ammon and Moab, who are these two vicious nations that refuse to sell the Jewish people food and drink on the way out down to the promised land, they're created. Moab literally means from my father. Moab, Me'av. Now, of course, Moab is the great-grandfather of Ruth. Ruth the Moabitess. So you have an act of yivam, it's gross yivam, absolutely, but it is sort of a weird form of levirate marriage, trying to carry on humanity when there's no chance for humanity to live. That's the selfless act. I mean, the daughters of Lot did not do this with lasciviousness. It was gross. It was abhorrent to them, clearly. There's no, you know, arousal there. It's gross. Okay, what about on the Boaz side? Well, we spoke about this last week. Tamar marries Judah's oldest son. He dies. Then the second brother marries her. He dies because he doesn't want to have a child that belongs to his dead brother. The third child is waiting to do yivam with Tamar. Tamar waits and waits and waits at home. Clearly, Judah doesn't want his youngest son to marry because he thinks she's a jinx and all the sons have died. So he says, wait, 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 wait. And of course, she's waited enough. She then says, well, if I can't have your son, I'll have you, Judah, right? So she goes out in the street and she solicits him and they have their union and we know the story. Now, that's also a form of yivam. That's levirate marriage. Again, it's a very bizarre form where the father has to take the place of the son. It should be the son doing the levirate marriage, but it is still pre-biblical times. This is before the Torah is given. So it's a form of yivam. So you have a yivam of the daughters of Lot that create Ruth. The yivam of Tamar and Judah that creates Boaz's side. And then, of course, magically, what else could you expect? But the two unions of Boaz and Ruth is a form of levirate marriage, because Boaz steps in for Mahlon, the dead husband of Ruth, and that child, Oved, essentially is the recreation of Mahlon, who died. Remember we said Mahlon's name had a dual translation. One was disease, the other was Mechila, to be forgiven in the eyes of God. And that redeems Elimelech, the father who died. It redeems Mahlon, and of course Naomi. And through the union of Ruth and Boaz, you create King David and the Mashiach. Now, you want to hear something stunning? There's a famous medrash that says that Adam, the first man, so we're talking about Adam in the form of all humanity, is shown every future event. And he sees this magical person, David, playing the harp, writing psalms, winning the wars, setting the stage for the temple to be built in Jerusalem. And then God says, oh, by the way, David, just potential, he's never going to be born. At this point, he's going to die. His mom's going to miscarry him. He's never going to be born. And Adam is like devastated. He said, well, what if I gave for my 1,000 years? Would it be appropriate, God, to give up my life to that David could be born? He says, sure. Now, of course, we're talking metaphorically. So Adam gives 70 years of his 1,000 years so that David is born. This is the ultimate expression of levirate marriage, because it's the gift of life. You're giving that child to the dead brother. Adam is humanity. Humanity is giving 70 years of itself, of its own life, so that David can be born. Well, David's only born this ultimate sacrifice of Adam. So we all think it's like a little fairy tale when we're little kids. We hear, oh, 70 years and King David from Adam. But it's not, because we're talking of Adam as humankind. Not talking about Jews anymore, even. We're talking about humanity. Adam is just everybody's father, right? So we're talking about Adam giving 70 years so that David, who only can be created through a mutual relationship. Remember, Lot and his daughters, there's no mutuality. There's no love on either side. One's not even aware of what's going on. He's stone drunk. Judah and Tamar, well, there's awareness on Tamar's behalf. She loves him. Judah doesn't even know that it's Tamar, so how could there be love? But then the love magically happens between the octogenarian 80-year-old Boaz and 40-year-old Ruth, creating Mr. Love David, which is the ultimate gift. And that's the gift given to Naomi, to Elimelech. That's the yivam, the selflessness to rebuild the family. But that gift is predicated on the 70-year gift of humanity that David should be given to all of humankind to be the great David. So all of it comes from this selflessness. And that selflessness comes from a word that doesn't even appear in the Megillah, Eli. That's just gone. So from one word, Eli, you have the Melech, Eli HaMelech. So that king, which is referring directly to David, can only exist if you throw away the me. If it's for me, if there's an agenda here, it can't happen. The agenda has to be thrown out the window. So the Megillah, in the most profound way possible, says that word's not even going to be here. It's going to rectify Eli Melech's mistake, and it's going to bring us Mashiach one day. So it should be that through our selflessness, our unselfish actions, that we should perpetrate and continue to carry on selfless acts that will one day, b'mehera b'meinu, lead to the Mashiach.